JEA names its controversial interim leader, the utility's permanent CEO, amid questions and suspicion about why he's getting the role. Your calls just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, we want your calls on JEA's controversial new pick, Aaron Zahn, to be its CEO. What are your thoughts, questions? Call us now, 549-2937. Then later, how urban farming is seeding our First Coast. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, in a highly controversial move, JEA's Board of Directors Tuesday unanimously named Aaron Zahn as the public utility's next CEO. The 38-year-old Zahn will lead the nation's eighth largest municipally owned electric, water, and wastewater utility. Despite having no experience leading a utility of any size other than his less than a year interim appointment. Now, he had been serving as JEA's interim CEO, and there was controversy over that appointment as well. Zahn was chosen yesterday over a field of experienced utility executives. He is seen as a favorite of Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry, and critics of Zahn's appointment are questioning whether this is perhaps a backdoor way for the mayor to revive talks of privatizing JEA, you know, selling the utility off, so that the city could potentially reap a big cash windfall. David Cotton is a reporter for the Jacksonville Daily Record. He was at yesterday's board meeting, covered it, and joins us now. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. Already getting calls about JEA's appointment of Aaron Zahn as its permanent CEO. What do you think? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or tweets to @MelissaInJax. And for months, there was a narrative that had taken hold around Zahn's appointment, that it was likely a foregone conclusion that perhaps the fix was in for him. So not many were surprised with this turn of events with the board choosing Zahn. Still, though, there was a process. Other candidates were interviewed publicly. You were there. What did you see?
Well, that was a pretty long meeting yesterday. It went from about noon to 4 o'clock, and each candidate had about 45 minutes to answer questions and sort of plead their case to this seven-member board, all of whom are appointed by the mayor at this point. You had Aaron Zahn, again, who's this younger guy, doesn't really have the utility experience, but then you've got two other very, very qualified people. Chris Uster, he's basically second in command at CPS Energy in San Antonio, the largest municipal-owned utility in the country. This guy is an MIT grad. He's got a doctorate in electrical engineering, decades of experience. And then you've got Pamela Hill, also decades of experience. She ran utilities in Jamaica and in the Bahamas. She's been in the industry for a long time. People with really, really high, really, really good credentials. In fact, when the board of directors decided, okay, we're going to score these people on all these different, you know, categories, both of them received, you know, pretty high marks in some cases, mm-hmm. higher than Zahn in some cases.
Mm-hmm. But yet Zahn was chosen.
Absolutely.
And what did the board say about that? Didn't the board chair, Alan Howard, give a lengthy speech denying any perception that the mayor's office was pulling the strings on this appointment?
Yeah, he made it a point at the beginning of the meeting to say, you know, to basically criticize, you know, reporters in this market who have written about this, you know, have covered the situation and have kind of connected the dots. He made a point of saying, you know, it was disrespectful to the board, and it was disrespectful specifically to Zahn to say that he wasn't qualified. He also tried to distance himself from the mayor's office, the board. Again, these are people the mayor appointed, so there is some connection there. Tried to distance himself from that, and also distance himself from the fact that, you know, yeah, the fix was in, that people assumed that Aaron Zahn was going to get this job.
It's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment on this story. And I think the reason this perception took hold is because when the former CEO Paul McElroy retired last year, Aaron Zahn was a board member of JEA at that time. McElroy appointed a woman named Melissa Dykes, who had been at the utility for over 20 years, to be the next CEO on an interim basis, I believe. Then when Aaron Zahn, a board member, expressed interest in the job, the board just gave him the job over this much more qualified, experienced executive who'd been with the utility for many years. And amidst all that, all of a sudden, talks of privatizing JEA sprang up into the public conversation. And reporters like you, who have been covering this, traced Zahn's appointment as perhaps a backdoor way for City Hall to begin the work of eventually privatizing the utility. Then the public rose up and said, no, we don't want JEA privatized. So now that Zahn is in the role permanently, will the mayor, will City Hall bring this up again, say, next year?
Well, I think if we're going to see any movement on that front, it'll be after city council elections. The new city council will come on in I believe, June or July. Next summer, you'll have a lot of new faces. There's a lot of candidates that, you know, will be connected to Mayor Lenny Curry who are coming through the pipeline right now. Two of his biggest critics, Anna Brochet and Garrett Dennis, have not filed for re-election in their seats. It's been teased that Anna could possibly run for mayor. We're not sure what Garrett wants to do, but so people like that will probably likely not be on council next year, giving the path. Now, we saw the referendum, the non-binding referendum at the midterm elections this year, where a majority of Duval County voters said, if you're going to privatize JEA more than 10%, we want to say.
Yeah. And so the public certainly spoke loudly on that front. But at the same time, could a potential challenger to Mayor Curry, who's got a very well-funded reelection war chest to the tune of, I think, $3 million or so, can a challenger make hay out of this JEA issue or not? Is the public even paying close enough attention to this for this to become a serious campaign issue?
I think it's certainly a challenge. Will it be something that will get somebody over the edge in an election? I'm not sure. I'm not sure everybody is sold on the city of Jacksonville being in the utility business in a very volatile electric industry. I believe Aaron Zahn mentioned it yesterday during his interview that the wastewater and the water side of the business is going to be it's going to bring higher revenue than the electric business very soon. And so whether or not they privatize the entire company, I think a very good possibility is you'll see this idea of maybe we can privatize parts of the business.
Okay. And then going beyond that whole issue, which has certainly been controversial for Duval, at the same time, we now have a 38-year-old executive who's never led a major utility before, running one of the largest public utilities in America as we head next year into a new hurricane season and as the utility deals with issues with a nuclear power plant up in Georgia, struggling how to convert to more renewable forms of energy, struggling with a whole host of issues plaguing the energy industry. And so the question I think critics of this whole process have had is this individual truly qualified to lead JEA through this complex roadmap of challenges?
Well, Nate Munro of the Florida Times Union wrote a good story on this yesterday about how this JEA CEO position has become more of a figurehead role. We mentioned Melissa Dykes earlier. She was the CFO last year. She's now the chief operating officer. She's somebody who runs this utility day to day. Zahn and the board, I think, you know, caught a break a little bit this season. We haven't had a major hurricane this fall. That doesn't mean one won't happen next year, but, you know, they were able to sort of skate by this year without having to deal with that major disaster. When we talk about Plant Vogtle, Zahn is the one who started this fight to get out of this power purchase agreement in which JEA ratepayers could be on the hook for about $2 billion when it's all said and done, whether this nuclear power plant expansion happens or not. That affected the credit rating agencies, that, you know, affected our bond ratings. It's a lot. There's a lot of negatives that I think people are appropriate, that, you know, people are appropriate in having some reservations about Aaron Zahn, given the track record the last 7-8 months.
All right, let's go to your calls on JEA's new appointment as Aaron Zahn becomes the utility's permanent CEO, 549-2937. Mike on the South Side. Hi, Mike. Good morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It's been a while since I called in.
So oh, I'm glad you're calling again.
Topic. Yeah, yeah. I'm watching all this play out, and I can't help but think that Curry is taking this right out of the Trump playbook. You know, take somebody who's obviously, so obviously not qualified for the position and put them in solely to move forward his agenda against the will and common sense of everybody else in the room, and then play the game of, really? And so I'd be interested if anybody's thrown that out or made that connection, because this just seems to be right out of that playbook. It's kind of sad to watch. I mean, if we were to lose JEA, the potential for, you know, rates to go up and us to wind up in a situation like a good example, Chicago with parking meters, you know, they privatized that and now that's a mess. You know, there's privatizing isn't always the answer, and I can't help but think that privatizing JEA would be bad on the long term. So just kind of wondering about those two things. Thanks, and I'll listen off the air.
Thank you, Mike. And the whole argument for privatizing JEA would be the city could get anywhere from $2 to $6 billion. They could pay down a whole mountain of debt. They could then start funding other priorities. That was the pro-privatization argument. But as Mike said, and so many other voters out there have said, they don't buy that argument. They don't want to see the utility privatized for that reason.
Yeah, right now the CEO of JEA, if something bad goes wrong, you know, if something bad happens, they got to go right in front of city council and they've got to be accountable, at least in theory. A private operator is not going to do that. Now, there's also the fact that, you know, JEA doesn't pay property taxes, you know, so there's that you can finagle the money there somehow as far as the loss of the annual contribution and all that. But to his point about, you know, Mayor Curry, I mean, he purged all the boards and commissions. The board members are all his appointments. So I can see that connection.
That is one of the first things this mayor did when he was elected. He purged the JEA board and a lot of other boards and commissions with people that had been in place and appointed loyalists. And so the controversy really stems from that move, which going back almost 4 years.
Yeah. And, you know, he operates like no other mayor in Jacksonville history right now. I mean, he's the first one to have a political action committee supporting him and his priorities, besides just the board appointments.
Eric at the Beaches. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Okay, thanks.
Basically reflecting somewhat of what you just said, my concern is, number one, is the playbook that Curry brought into office as head of the Republican Party for the state of Florida at one point and also the county was that privatization is the rule, not the alternative. Whenever a Republican takes power in a particular place, the idea is because they ideologically believe that, you know, public just doesn't work, private is the best. That's a nice thing. But the other aspect is that, again, the board. I mean, he went against the tradition of which leaving at least remnants of past authorities on the board so there would be a diverse opinion. Diversity doesn't seem to work for Curry. It's got to be people that are just his own. And finally, those are the people that are approving the guy that Curry likes the most. So I don't see how the public really was involved at all in that decision, since Curry had made it a top-down thing from the very beginning. So, you know, same old, same old. Thanks.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah, you know, the reason a lot of these terms on these boards and commissions are staggered is so that they overlap coming and going mayoral administrations, so as to prevent too much uniformity of thought, groupthink.
Yeah.
But when you do a purge, you get rid of that dynamic.
You absolutely do. And it may take some time. You know, there's some people whose terms, you know, might not, you know, there's some people that, you know, may have stuck around that, you know, maybe were sympathetic to Curry to begin with, but weren't his pick that he is now backfilled. But it's a strong mayor form of government here in Jacksonville. That's kind of what you get. Any mayor could do that. Lenny just chose to.
Let's go to Stanley. He's downtown. Hi, Stanley. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Yes, my main concern, if you look at DIA, JEA, and Kids Hope Alliance, you can see the mayor in every area controlling everything, especially when the people, when it comes to crime prevention here, where people's lives are at stake, the mayor's leadership is appalling. And you can see the same thing across the board. And I agree with everybody who has spoken at this point. I agree with them 100%. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I want to say one thing. You know, yesterday during this evaluation, you had two board members on JEA specifically get very agitated with Chris Uster. Chris Uster is probably the most qualified person to have interviewed for this position. Because he didn't
more take, qualified than Mr. Zahn?
Absolutely. If you're looking at industry experience, sure. They took exception with the fact that Mr. Uster was not prepared to say, yes, finally, I will take this job today. Where do I sign the paperwork? When we know that there's going to be probably a few weeks of negotiations anyways. John Campion made a comment about, who's a board member, made a comment about Mr. Uster not driving through a storm, you know, through the panhandle. You know, he's critical of his video interview the first round. During the first round of interviews, Uster did a video interview, and it was because, you know, Hurricane Michael was like coming across the state at that time.
So they didn't like the fact that he didn't drive here through Hurricane Michael.
I mean, basically. I mean, it was, you know, that, and this was framed as, well, if you're not passionate enough to get here and find travel arrangements, then maybe you're not the right person. He also hit him because, you know, he said, well, other candidates spent days here. You spent 24 hours. Well, okay. He was here in Jacksonville yesterday. He was interviewing for the job. He said he would take the job, but he was not prepared to actually make that concrete decision until he went back, talked to his family, talked with his board. I mean, April Green made the comment that it seemed like he was building leverage for himself to renegotiate his situation in San Antonio.
That could be. At the same time, another member of the city council who's term limited, Matt Schellenberg, appeared on this program recently and said he was concerned about this process, noting that other candidates who were being considered for the job were dropping out because he said they believed that the fix was already in for this internal candidate.
Yeah, Frankie McDermott, who is who's over in Sacramento with the utility company there, you know, backed out last week. You know, he sent the board an email, which of course was made public because they wanted it to be made public, showing that, you know, he didn't want to uproot his family from, you know, the Sacramento area. He's got grandkids, that sort of thing. What's interesting about that is during this, one of the subcommittees where they named all these finalists, the biggest thing about Frankie McDermott was how passionate he was about Jacksonville and how much he wanted to be here. And then all of a sudden it's, well, I want to spend time with my family. And, you know, it just seemed like kind of an odd way to back out of it.
Okay, lots of emails and tweets. Let's get to a few of them as we talk about JEA's new CEO amid much criticism of the process, appointing new leader Aaron Zahn. Our guest today, David Cotton of the Daily Record, and lots of tweets from everyone. Here is one from Jim. They picked the least qualified to run JEA. The fix is in. As the TU says today, it's Deja Duval. He's referring to a column from Mark Woods, noting there's been a whole string of these types of incidents. Jay tweets the show, selling JEA would be killing the goose that laid the golden egg for a quick meal. Brian, it's disrespectful of people's time to call them in if the mayor always planned to hire his inexpert favorite. It's like calling in tradesmen for estimates when you already have your guy. It's low. Another tweet. Appointing and hiring low-qualified candidates is how JEA got the bad Vogel deal to begin with. Having a board and CEO who goes along to get along is not looking out for the actual owners, the citizens. It's disgusting. Here's another tweet. Selling JEA makes about as much sense as selling a home you already own and paying somebody else rent for it. Here's an email from Ricardo. This whole thing shows how politicians are using and abusing the cover of due process to ram through their folks an agenda. This is not how mature democracy is supposed to work. It's more reminiscent of how things are done in third world countries. And these heavy-handed tactics start as politics but always lead to outright corruption. What a disgrace. So the perception out there, at least among our listeners, is that this process is corrupt, heavy-handed, reminiscent of machine politics or even a third world country. Pretty harsh.
Well, you know, JEA spent $190,000 contracting with this executive search firm. It's the same firm that they've used previously. And, you know, the whole time, you know, they tried to, in public meetings, say, you know, this is very transparent, it's very open. But when you go back and you look at the nine finalists, the nine people who they really considered for this job, they're all decades of industry experience, executive experience. And then you've got Aaron Zahn, who, if he were not the interim CEO for the last 7 months, And that, you know, that goes somewhere. But if he would not have had that experience, he wouldn't have been on
the
finalist.
There were also issues with Zahn's tenure leading energy or wastewater, not wastewater, but waste companies.
Yeah.
This appointment.
Yeah. The Times Union has, Nate and Chris over there have reported on this a lot about his, this waste company that had contracts in Stark and another small city in Florida that, you know, was so bad they actually had to close down their operations there. So he's, you know, while he did have success at that company, there were some cases where they did not have very good track records.
Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning. I'm just calling to comment on, if JEA is privatized, there not being any accountability to the city council is a big issue. But I think it's more of a problem that Aaron Zahn doesn't have any experience running a utilities company, but more importantly, that he has had serious problems as the CEO of his former company called BCR Nuterra. So, for example, in Stark and in Haines, two cities in Florida, there was a terrible smell of raw sewage that I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of. And that was really because, in effect, Zahn's prior company was just moving the sewage around instead of treating it as was promised. And as a result, the city of Stark sued Zahn's company for almost $2 million. And instead of coming to a resolution, BCR Nuterra simply reformed so that it was impossible to recover any money. The same thing happened in Haines, except the city of Haines simply canceled the contract. And then while Zahn was CEO of this company, employees report that it was extremely unprofessional, that there was routinely cursing in the office, and some employees even report that they were directed to violate EPA standards. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks for that. That has all been publicly reported. And so this whole narrative, honestly, that has taken hold around this is such that even average Joes out there who might not normally follow what goes on at a utility, they're following this so closely. I mean, just judge. It's really remarkable, David. Yeah, we have so many more calls on hold.
I mean, it's not a great look. I mean, not only for JEA, but for the city of Jacksonville. And look, I'm not, who am I to say that Aaron Zahn is not qualified to do this? But I think when the industry is pushing back on him for the last 7 months, when you have had to, you know, make him look better than he is, go out of your way to make him look the part, I think there's an issue there.
Daryl in St. Augustine. Hello, Daryl.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, I mean, this is the same playbook over and over, as they said earlier, by the Republican Party, whether it's charter schools or private prisons or the sale of JEA, it is the socialization of the expenses and the privatization of the profits. Very simple.
And so that's the motive you see, Daryl?
Absolutely. There's no doubt. They're going to put their guy in there, and they're going to pass on all of the expenses to the citizens and the payers of the for JEA, and they're going to skim off all of the profits the same way they do when they take your property tax and invest in a charter school. They just send it to their cronies. This is exactly what they do in Russia.
Wow. Okay.
The America's oligarchy.
Thanks for that. Okay. Let's talk about his comments, because certainly the straw ballot, which voters have approved a non-binding referendum saying that they must have a say in more than 10% of this utility. The reason for that, David, is I think because of what that caller just said. Voters perceive that if JEA is sold off, let's say to Florida Power and Light or Duke Energy, that eventually, not right away, but eventually our rates will go up, maybe significantly, and that we will assume the cost. And certainly ratepayers are not happy about that. What about the deeper remarks he was making, saying that this smacks of oligarchy?
Yeah, I don't know if Jacksonville's quite there yet, but there certainly seems to be traces of putting in your guy, putting in the people who are going to be loyal to you, You know, the Republican Party has always held this belief that the private sector can always do things more efficiently than the government can. We see it with charter schools. We see it with all these other issues. But, you know, I want to be very clear to our listeners. There is no legislation. There is no move right now currently at JEA to privatize. Not to say that that couldn't happen again next summer, but right now there's no legislation, no resolution, nothing on that front.
Let's go. One more call. It's Linda in Deerwood. Hi, Linda. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. I must admit, I haven't been listening in a while. Sometimes it could be stressful listening to current events. But
I hear you, Linda. We get stressed out too.
I just want to tell everybody who's calling in very passionate, what are you going to do about it? Time to stop complaining about the government we have and get the government we deserve. Or is this the government we deserve? I want a new hashtag, anybody but Lenny. This is like the presidency to me, the fallacy of strong mayor. Strong mayor is built on having a partner with the city council and with the other forms of government. When you have someone that's not concerned about that, then things go amok. So I want to ask my citizens, let's stop crying about it. What are we going to do about it in 2 years?
All right. Thanks, Linda. Thanks for that. And that gets us back to the point you made earlier, David. Will this controversial series of events fuel a mayoral challenge in January?
Yeah, qualifying's coming up in less than 2 months. You know, there are several smaller candidates in there, but nobody is, you know, raising money right now. The rumor has been for months that Anna Brochet, the most recent council president, is going to run. She has not said that very clearly, but she would probably be, you know, minus a big name Democrat. She's also a Republican, so keep that in mind. But besides any big name Democrats that have, you know, are waiting and maybe to surprise us, there's nobody that's going to really challenge him this cycle. You're also going to see on city council more favorability for the mayor with new candidates that are coming up. There are people that are running in these seats. There's a lot of open seats because there's a lot of city council members who are termed out. And so you're going to just refill those with people who support the mayor.
Okay. And we will continue to follow this. It's going to be interesting to see what 2019 holds, certainly.
Keeps us busy.
Yes, always busy. And always good to have you on the show. David Cotton of The Daily Record, thanks for sharing your insights and your reporting. Much more still ahead later. How you can help kids in the Panhandle have a good holiday this year in the aftermath of Hurricane Michael. But up next, urban farming comes to the First Coast. That's in our Going Green.
Join WJCT and AARP for a community-wide Shred It Day, Saturday, December 1st, 9 a.m. till noon, located at WJCT 100 Festival Park Avenue. For more info, go to wjct.org/events.
End the 2018 Jaguar season on a high note. Treat yourself to a live jazz brunch on Sunday, December 16th, from 10 a.m. to kickoff at WJCT Studios. Enjoy live music by Jaguar Jazz featuring saxophonist Tracy Morris and an eclectic brunch menu curated by celebrity Chef Cartel. Quench your pregame thirst with the Mimosa Fountain or select your own libation at the Cash Bar. For tickets and group seating, visit 904tix.com and search Jazz Brunch.
Welcome back. Well, now that Florida voters have approved Amendment 13, which effectively ends greyhound racing in the state by 2020, thousands of dogs need new homes. But before you run to the nearest track with hopes of taking home a canine companion, you need to know a few things first. Christine DeMattei chats with Joyce Carter about this. She's Vice President of Greyhound Adoptions of Florida.
Joyce, first off, do we know exactly how many racing greyhounds are still in Florida racetracks?
We do not have an accurate count. This is a piece of information that varies because dogs come into tracks, dogs leave tracks. Best we can determine is that there are approximately 3,700 active racing dogs in Florida now. That does not count the non-racing dogs. It does not count the dogs who are in training or the puppies or the brood moms. There are a number of animals that contribute to the racing population that certainly would be affected by Amendment 13, but they are not counted as part of the racing dogs.
Okay, so let's say 4,000 dogs. There are many dog lovers throughout Florida probably thinking, okay, great, Amendment 13 is passed, so all of these athlete dogs are now going to be needing a forever home, so I'm just going to go to the nearest racetrack and go adopt a dog. But it's not that simple, is it, Joyce?
No, it is not. For one thing, there are a great number of tracks that will not cease racing until the end of 2020. So the dogs that might be coming off in a great lump at the end of 2020 are not now available for adoption. And I have sitting in my inbox, I think at last count it was 79 emails from people who were interested in adopting a dog, thinking the same way. That now that racing is done, all the dogs need homes. And the truth is that racing isn't quite done, and the homes that the dogs will be getting will be carefully orchestrated by, we certainly hope, responsible members of the industry, along with the Greyhound Adoption Action Alliance. We want to make sure these dogs get what they deserve. And you know what? They all deserve a couch. A nice, soft, comfy couch. That's what they deserve.
What kind of pets do they make?
Well, please understand, you're asking someone who's very biased. These are gentle, loving, sensitive, and highly intelligent and perceptive animals. What they need help with is that since their puppyhoods have been spent in big kennels and at racetracks, they don't know a lot of what goes into a house. They have no experience with windows, so sliding glass doors. A lot of people put tape, like painter's tape, on doors at dog level so that the dog sees that there's something solid there. They need help. But once they master it, chances are you will have a companion Velcroed to your side for the next, hopefully, 10 years, who will love you to pieces.
We've been talking with Joyce Carter, Vice President of Greyhound Adoptions of Florida. If you'd like to learn more about greyhound adoption, including where to find adoption groups in your area, Joyce recommends visiting the website greyhoundadoptionactionalliance.org.
That was reporter Christine DeMattei, and we'll be right back.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Well, by the year 2050, the world will need to feed some 10 billion people. We've got to increase our farming by about 50% in order to meet that huge demand. But at the same time, there's a problem as we are losing farmland at an alarming rate. So experts in agriculture say it's time to change the way we grow our food and bring it closer to urban city centers, urban farming. This is what a local company is working to do with an innovative model. Angela Tenbroek is the CEO of Jacksonville's Pura Farms. It's an urban farm, and she joins us now with more in today's Going Green. Angela, good morning.
Thanks, Melissa. Thanks for having us.
This is great. You know, this is not a new trend, by the way, moving farms closer to the consumer, local sustainable agriculture, but you've kicked it up to an even higher level with Pura Farms. Tell me about Pura Farms.
Yeah, so what we're trying to do is, as you know, we've done a lot of people in the community have done really good work at bringing, you know, food to the community as far as planting in the dirt and so forth. But what we found was is we actually need to increase the density into which we farm, you know, in the communities. So what we're looking to do is we are taking for every, say, a quarter acre we have under cover, under a greenhouse, we actually produce 1 acre of food per month. Mm-hmm. So many farms are producing only one product. At our farms, we're actually producing upwards of 31.
What are you producing?
So we're producing, you know, salad greens, the normal kind of greenhouse stuff. So salad greens, herbs. We kicked it up with tomatoes, eggplant, squash, cucumber, and such. So we have other opportunity, you know, other things people eat that, you know, like this week we have a whole variety of herbs. We have Swiss chards. We have tomatoes. We have different varieties of tomatoes. Many people, when they think of a tomato, they go to the grocery store and they look at those and they think, ugh. Mm-hmm. What we have is people come to our farm and they try our tomatoes and literally, we have to kind of go, hands off, we have to sell those.
Because yours look so good.
Yeah, they taste so good too.
This is local sustainable farming with no pesticides, no chemicals. You're doing this the way our ancestors did it, but you're doing it in the city.
Yeah, that's an interesting part here is that, you know, we don't use chemicals to grow our food. You know, we don't use the soil and such. So it's an aquaponics. So meaning that we use fish and the fish waste to produce our fertilizer. So we've actually found through the, you know, many years of doing this that we're able to produce a high quality fertilizer within our facilities through the fish emulsion. So it allows mm-hmm. us to propel our plants to grow faster. They taste better. They last longer. And it's a sustainable practice right there in your community.
Why is it so important to convert to this method of agriculture as we look down the road to, say, as I said, the year 2050?
Yeah. So it takes 1,000 years to make good topsoil. And, you know, we have people in our community that are actually helping with, you know, move that faster. But with the fact that we have to obviously increase the amount of food people who are coming to the urban core to grow, to need food. The society, you know, world's economies are kind of becoming more affluent. So people are, there's more pressure on resources. And so because of the situation that we find ourselves in is that we have to feed all these people. And in America, we're losing 20,000 farms a year. So the situation that we find ourselves in is that we must figure a different way other than soil growing. There's nothing wrong with that. My family have farmed for many generations in the soil and many good farmers we know. But we have to be able to do it year-round in the same place so that people get used to, you know, an opportunity to have highly wholesome food right there down the road from their, you know, their house.
Yeah. And this is such a public health issue as well. In this city and so many others, there are big, huge swaths of land that are known as food deserts where people don't have access to fresh produce and whole foods. There's no grocery store. There's no way to get healthy food. And so urban community gardens have started to spring up in a sort of patchwork way to try to address that. But what you're doing is a much more comprehensive and big approach with Pura Farms. And by the way, you're located at I-10 and Chaffee, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. So what's a little bit different about our farming technique is that we're trying to do direct to consumer. So at our farms, we have our next phase of our development is what we call a farm and go. So at the street side, farm and go is a 24-hour vending opportunity for people to be able to access fresh produce in their communities. What we find mm-hmm. in limited access food areas, also known as food deserts or food swamps, people actually, grocery stores cannot sustain themselves. So they don't want to necessarily, it's a business opportunity for them. They don't really want to go into those communities because they don't see it as an opportunity to make, you know, $1 million a week. Whereas in the 24-hour venting opportunity, people can actually access vegetables 24 hours a day. And so what we're trying to do is actually working with the city of Jacksonville to put these fresh available produce vending opportunities, we call Farmingos, as part of our facility. So at that point, we'll have 200 SKUs. Obviously, I don't grow 200 products. So we will access products from people like Community Loaves and other places to fill our vending that's all local. So the idea is to spread the local farming as well as artisans in the community.
Pretty cool. And by the way, people can come visit you
and
tour the farm and buy the produce. Tell us how that works.
Yeah, so we're open 5 days a week, Monday through Friday. Our farmers, as we call them, get there about 7:30.
Farmers?
Yes,
farmers. It's an all-female staff?
That's right.
Very
we're
nice.
We're an all-female staff, kind of keeping with the the spirit of what we do. Women
do you go
best.
To, are you on farmersonly.com? Just kidding.
No. Maybe some of the ladies are.
How funny.
Farmersonly.com is an interesting different conversation.
Yeah.
So we're open, generally we like to tell people to get there before 12 because even in the winter days like today, it'll get warm in the greenhouses. And so we like to show people around kind of, around 10 o'clock or so. Show them kind of what we're doing. It's a community spot. It's a really great spot. We have the premise of build a longer table, not a higher fence. So we took all of our found items that when we were building our farm and built a table that seats 30. So we actually have farm dinners on weekends and such like that. And a lot of good farmers in our community, and we're just trying to fit in and kind of grow food as we can.
It's so great. And you can go to the website. It's fooderyfarms.com. Fooderyfarms.com to learn more about Pura Farms, which is the corporate name, and it's Angela Tenbrook, CEO of Jacksonville's own Pura Farms. You can go and tour it right in the city and buy some produce and go to one of the dinners too. So check it out. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
And in a moment, how you can help those still struggling in the panhandle months after Hurricane Michael. That's next.
CNS Healthcare is offering an Alzheimer's research study focused on management of agitation and aggression. Has Alzheimer's changed your loved one? Have they become verbally or physically abusive? Learn more at cnshealthcare.com.
Join WJCT and AARP for a community-wide Shred It Day, Saturday, December 1st, 9 a.m. till noon, located at WJCT 100 Festival Park Avenue. For more info, go to wjct.org/events.
Divorce attorneys are busy as ever, and their clients, they've got a deadline.
They fight about everything, but knowing that you have to be done by December 31st, they're willing to maybe concede some issues that they wouldn't have before.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the new tax law and divorce court, next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Facebook's leadership say people need to trust their platform.
That the content they're seeing is valid and they need to trust the connections they make.
But does anyone trust their leadership? Facing crisis after crisis, we're asking whether the social media company can be held accountable or if it's too big to fail. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
They say you can find everything online, but movie buffs know that's just not true. Hundreds of classic, cult, and priceless films are missing. The lack of access to Hollywood's back catalog is worrying fans, directors, and historians. Why so many films will not be coming soon to a screen near you, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, as the holiday season gets underway, here's a reminder for you not to forget folks over in the Panhandle. That region of Florida is still suffering widespread devastation nearly 2 months after Hurricane Michael. This weekend, there's a big toy drive happening here in Jacksonville for people in the Panhandle. Organizer Hillary Keeley is here now to tell us all about it. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Now, you live here, but your mother is the mayor of Lynn Haven, Florida, which is in the Panhandle. So you have a personal connection to what's happening over there.
Absolutely. And last weekend, we were in Lynn Haven doing a Thanksgiving dinner. We served Thanksgiving for over 500 people, and now we've kicked into holiday spirit and working on the toy drive.
Sure. And in a moment, we'll tell people how they can contribute. But first, let me ask you, what was it like over there at Thanksgiving? How bad is the situation right now?
It's really bad that there are people who are still displaced from their homes. There are people that are still waiting on temporary housing. They're living in tents in their neighborhoods and at church parking lots waiting for blankets and heaters. And so it still is very devastating. And
so tent cities, literally, over there in the Panhandle.
There are.
It's just incredible. FEMA is on the ground there.
But
local efforts like yours are really, they're kind of filling in the gaps, it seems like. Is that right?
Absolutely. That FEMA is standing by ready to place trailers, but there's things that have to get put in place, that the electric and sewage lines and things that make those be able to be habitable.
And this is a part of Florida that doesn't normally get struck by a major storm. And so in a sense, I guess the Panhandle was caught a little unawares. It's just been a devastating turn of events for that region.
It has. That on Monday, the storm was a tropical storm, maybe a Category 1, and by Wednesday was a Category 4, approaching a 5. And so it was something that people were caught off guard.
And how is your mother dealing with this as an elected official?
I think she wears the brunt of 8,000 families on her shoulders, and that she spends every day in a golf cart driving around asking what people need on a very granular basis. And that's kind of how we have found these grassroots ways of helping. It's things that families need immediately.
Right. So you know what the needs are because she's talking to folks. So this brings us then to the big event. You are hosting a big toy drive this weekend for Panhandle Relief. Tell us what's on the agenda.
Absolutely. So these are families that would have never benefited from a charity toy drive, but for the fact that they've lost everything. They're waiting on insurance deductibles or insurance payments to come out. And it's all hitting right here at the holidays. And so this is a toy drive that is going to directly benefit the citizens of Lynn Haven from December 12th through the 15th, that all of the citizens can go to a Christmas village and that they can shop for their children, that the city's going to be handing out Lynn Haven bucks, that there's no income requirement. It's just if you need gifts, you show up. And
Everyone's eligible.
Everyone's eligible. And it's an opportunity to take some of the financial stress off of these families that are going through so much.
So how can people contribute?
Sure. So on Saturday from 10 until 3, we have a location. It's David Weekly Homes, their Title Point community near IKEA at Butler Boulevard and 295. That right by the town center. And we picked that location because it's centrally located by all the shopping. So as you're out and about, if you'll stop by, drop off an unwrapped gift, and it will go this weekend to the Panhandle.
So again, let's say exactly where that location is, because certainly people will be out doing their holiday shopping. They need to make a pit stop here when they're done and drop some stuff off for you. This is David Weekly Homes?
Yes, and it's their Title Point community, and it's near IKEA, and it's at the intersection of JTB, and it's in Gate Parkway is the exit, but it's right next to IKEA, and David Weekly is going to have sign holders pointing for directions, so if you can find your way there, we'll have wayfinding signs to help you make sure.
And can people bring items other than toys, or is this specifically a toy drive?
It's specifically a toy drive, but there are some needs for blankets. And so I would say if you'd like to bring blankets, that we could also take those just because the temperatures are dropping.
Okay. Yes, they certainly are. So if you are in the giving spirit, here's an easy way to help the Panhandle. This Saturday from 10 to 3 at the David Weekley Homes Title Point community right next to IKEA, drop off an unwrapped new toy or a blanket, because this toy drive will be happening and will benefit the good people of Lynn Haven, Florida. That is in the Panhandle, still devastated nearly 2 months after Hurricane Michael. This is an easy way you can help and won't take too much time out of your day. You know you're probably going to the town center this weekend to shop for holiday stuff. So add this into your day and help Hillary out. Her mother is the mayor of Lynn Haven, and she has organized this toy drive. So Hillary Keeley, thanks for all you do, and thank you for spreading the word here this morning with us.
Thank you.
All right, and that is our show. Thanks for listening. Michelle Corum is our director. Our theme is composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And if you missed anything this morning, you can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is 89.9. WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Stay warm out there. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.